There are at least 50,000 homeless students throughout Illinois, and there are laws designed to help and protect these young people. Today on the 21st, we hear one Bloomington woman's story of how she was homeless in high school. We talk to the organization that helped her, Project Oz, and we hear from the Chicago Coalition on the Homeless about what resources are available throughout the state. Also, Illinois State archaeologist Thomas Emerson joins us to talk about renewed energy into the movement to make the prehistoric city Cahokia a national monument. And later,
this is Embedded, an NPR podcast where we take a story from the news and go deep. And today we're going to Austin, Indiana, a town that back in the spring of 2015 was all over the news.
All Things Considered host Kelly McEvers, a Lincoln, Illinois native, joins us to talk about her new podcast, Embedded. That's coming up all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois schools have identified more than 50,000 homeless students. That was last year, but that number's been growing. And while there are programs to help young people who are homeless, the state budget crisis has been ripping a hole in parts of that safety net. Today on the 21st, we're going to talk about the reasons why so many young people end up without homes, what's driving the problem, and what communities throughout Illinois are doing to help. We wanted to start the conversation with Alexis Bishop. She's 23 now, but she was homeless during her junior and senior year in high school. She joins us by phone from Bloomington. Alexis, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
What happened during high school that left you homeless as a junior and senior?
It was unstable living with parents. They both chose to do different things in life. My mom chose to go back to school, so she could not afford to maintain a stable home for us. And then my father, he was not used to having children living in his home, so that did not work out as far as that living situation.
And this is while you were up in Chicago at the time. What high school were you going to at that point?
I was going to Niles West during one of those times, and then when I graduated from ETHS, I was not living with him.
Okay, and so when you were a junior and senior, did you stay at Niles West during all of your high school career?
I stayed at Niles West up until my junior year, which is around one of the times that I was homeless, and then senior year at the end of that was around one of the times. So around prom, I was sleeping on someone's couch.
And then what did you do? Did you just try to stay with different friends? Did you know that there were support networks available for you?
Well, actually, one of my family members, she found out about me and my father. She was kin to me on my father's side, and so she took me in, and I stayed on her couch.
I mean, I can't imagine just the normal stress of a high school student. You were talking about prom and then not really knowing where you're going to sleep on top of it. How did you handle all of that?
I think I handled it pretty well, especially because around the time that my cousin found out, it was literally right after my dad decided for me not to stay with him anymore. So it really worked out. I really appreciated that because I would probably ended up staying in my car. Because of the fact that I don't have that many family members, so I didn't have that much of a resource to turn around and go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. How did you end up getting in touch eventually with Project Oz?
In Bloomington, after I had my daughter, once again, I faced the possible,
the possibility of being homeless again.
And so I went to Mid-Central Community Action, and they told me about Project Oz and the funding that they had and all the criteria that you had to meet in order to be in the program, which I fitted that criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met with a caseworker on a regular basis and attended the life skills meetings on Mondays for the single mothers. And then I eventually went in front of a board and told them why, I needed to seek this opportunity to be in the program.
Mm-hmm. So now you're 23. You're a certified nurse's assistant. I know you're also enrolled in a radiology program at Heartland Community College.
Well,
so you
want to be in the radiology.
You want to be in the radiology program. Okay. But you've really, done a great job taking care of yourself the past couple of years. And I wanted to ask you, from the time you were a teenager up until now, how many different periods of time were there where you didn't know where you were going to have a place to stay?
Many, many times. If it wasn't for Project Oz, I don't know what I would do because I literally gave birth to my daughter May 2nd, and I had to be out of my apartment by May 10th. And I think I signed my lease on May 8th because of Project Oz, because I met with them on the 1st, and they approved me on the 1st.
Mm, okay.
So that turnaround was, really, really fast.
That's Alexis Bishop, who's talking to us from Bloomington. And I wanted to bring a couple other folks into the conversation. Also joining us from Bloomington is Sharice Larson. She's at Project Oz. She's a supervisor of the Homeless Youth Program. Sharice, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you so much.
I also wanted to welcome Julie Dworkin. She's the director of policy from the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, who's joining us from Chicago as well. Hey, Julie, how are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Julie, how typical is the story we're hearing from Alexis about all of these periods between, I guess, about like 14 to 23, where she just really didn't know where she was going to be staying?
Well, I think it's a story that I hear often, sort of this instability in the family. There's a variety of reasons that youth experience homelessness. It's a little bit different than adult homelessness. They're usually coming from serious family situations. There could be abuse in the home. There could be sexual abuse. Sometimes there's conflict with their family over their gender identity, their sexual orientation, or pregnancy. So there's a lot of different reasons that youth become homeless, but I think it's very common for them to, you know, move from house to house, what we call couch surfing. That's a really common way for youth to experience homelessness. There are resources out there, but there aren't enough to serve them all. So a lot of them end up sort of in that informal system.
I do want to talk about those resources in a minute, but I think we should define what homelessness means, especially when we're talking about high school students and younger adults. How should we define it?
Well, we define it as unaccompanied young people, meaning that they're homeless not with their families, between the ages of 14 and 24, who don't have a regular, safe, and stable place to stay.
That's Julie Dworkin. She's the director of policy with the Chicago Coalition on the Homeless. We're talking about high school students, youth homelessness throughout Illinois. If you have questions or comments, you can always give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show. Our handle is 21ST Show. Sharice Larson, you supervise the Homeless Youth Program at Project Oz in Bloomington. I know you all serve primarily teenagers. How do you find your clients?
You know, we find them in a variety of ways. We can go into the schools and touch base with them there if we know that they've either been identified as homeless or they're at risk of becoming homeless. We also find a lot of our clients just by doing street work and doing outreach on the street, by going into the shelters, different homeless shelters. Unfortunately, there aren't any youth shelters, but there are adult shelters, and so anybody over the age of 18 can stay there.
There's no youth shelters. There are no youth shelters in Bloomington.
Correct, yes.
And I wonder if you could tell us, Julie, how many youth shelters, are there any youth shelters outside of Chicago, Julie, or are they mostly all in Chicago?
There are shelters outside of Chicago. There's about 30 organizations throughout the state, including those in Chicago, that serve specifically this homeless youth population. And they may have emergency shelter. They may have transitional housing. That's a bit more common, where that you can stay for 18 months to 2 years. They also have outreach programs. They have different types of services in different areas.
And I imagine, Julie, the shelter situation is there are unique challenges with teenagers and housing in terms of you think about a typical shelter for adults. That might be a challenge, or there may even be legal or safety issues with having teenagers stay with adults.
Absolutely. I mean, youth are at a very different point in their life developmentally, and so we do think it's problematic when they're served in adult shelters. They can stay there if they're over 18, but they're usually not, the services are not usually tailored to their needs. It is a lot harder when we're talking about minors. There are very specific laws around how you have to serve minors, and the resources are a lot scarcer for youth that can't find a way to go home, but yet they're still a minor.
Alexis, did you ever stay at a shelter? Did you ever think about that?
I never stayed in a shelter, but it definitely was an option.
Why didn't you?
Because, like I said, my cousin took me in, and plus before that I was couch surfing, as they say. So if that would have been an option, like let's say one of my friends, their parents was like, hey, you can't stay here. You could stay here for a few nights, but not permanently. That would have definitely been an option as a shelter.
Mm-hmm. Julie, I wanted to ask you, especially as we're thinking about Alexis's situation, I know that under federal law, there are specific resources available for students who are homeless. And I wanted to know what whose responsibility does it often become to help channel those resources? Is it schools?
Yes, absolutely. Homeless youth and children have certain rights under state and federal law. They have the right to be immediately enrolled in school without presenting any type of identification or records. They have a choice of schools that they can go to. They have the right to transportation so that they can stay stable in one school. They have the right to have fees waived and other supports. So these are things that do fall on school districts to be able to identify youth and make sure that they're getting what they need to stay stable in school and succeed.
And do we have a sense? I know that ISBE, the Illinois State, in terms of school boards, I know that they've identified that last year there were at least 54,000 students identified by their schools as homeless. Does that mean that you think the identification of these students is happening through the proper channels throughout the school district system in Illinois? I'm going to start by asking you that question, Julie, and then, Sheris, I wanted to have you answer it as well.
They are definitely being identified. We think that they're not identifying all of them, and I think in particular the unaccompanied youth population is probably less likely to be identified. They're less likely to come forward or to know that they have rights or that they have resources. But overall, there's some federal money that comes to the state in order to help identify youth, but it's really not enough. And so these schools have these mandates that they have to follow, but there really isn't enough resources. And we've been fighting for years for the state to put in additional resources to help schools do this. But, with the budget situation, we haven't been successful.
Mm-hmm. Sheris, I don't know what the situation is in Bloomington. Do you feel like you're seeing those liaisons happening at schools, students getting transportation? Are those things happening in Bloomington?
You know, they're happening as long as they're identified, but that's the problem. Just like Julie said, there's a lack of knowledge of the homeless students in our community. I have a snapshot of about 6 months of the homeless students that have been identified in our districts here, and it's 190, which is a lot, but I would be willing to bet that there's quite a few more, and they're just not being captured. And so, just like Julie said, we need more people identifying them, and I think that's where agencies such as ourselves come in, because we can go into the schools and we can connect with these young people and maybe get a little bit more information out of them than they're sharing at school. And so then we have to advocate for them. And once we do, the schools are very good at getting their resources for them and providing transportation and providing enrollment, providing meals and any other school supplies and all of those things that any child should get.
Sheris, is Project Oz allowed into the schools in Bloomington? How does that work? Do you just kind of have to go there? And I imagine it's really challenging to figure out among this population there who's unaccompanied, right? Because it sounds like both Julie and Sheris, you're both saying families that are homeless, those students are probably getting more identified than students who are on their own and unaccompanied minors.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, we can go into the schools. We've got school-based workers as it is, so we already have a presence there at each of our main high schools in Bloomington Normal. So that's not really the issue, but like you said, the issue is identifying those kids, those young people, especially the 16 and 17-year-olds who may be couch surfing and aren't really telling their peers or telling their school counselors or telling their teachers. And those are the ones that we find it harder to connect with. But once we do, and once we kind of listen for those key words that they're saying, oh, you know, I didn't have a place to stay last night, or I'm coming in late every day to school, and this is why. And so you have to pick up on those clues to be able to identify them, and then we can start gathering the resources and saying, hey, you know, do you have a stable place to stay? Are you getting meals? Are you getting clothes? Are you getting the basic needs that you should be getting?
Alexis, when you were a junior and senior and you were couch surfing, did the people in your school know that you were staying at your cousin or you were in other places?
No. I never disclosed that information to, like, staff or...
Did you just feel like it wasn't pertinent, or did you think it didn't matter to them, or...
Back then, I really didn't know about resources around town, so I didn't think, like, oh, I can go here and it will help me. I just try to, like, figure it out on my own.
Yeah, that, and I mean, do you think it was, I mean, it sounds like that would have been really tough for you to figure this out on your own. That's a lot of responsibility for you to have when you're 15.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I feel like I wasn't mature enough to make those type of decisions, like, oh, go get help, go talk to a counselor, go, you know, things like that. So I kind of relied more on, like, instinct and you'll get through this.
Mm. Julie, what her high school, I guess particularly high school teachers and counselors, what are the signs that they should be looking for in terms of trying to determine whether students are in a situation like Alexis was in and then obviously don't feel like they want to share it with people?
Well, I think Cher's mentioned some of them, like coming to school late, being really tired in school, falling asleep, not having an opportunity to change their clothes every day or take a shower every day. Just students that were otherwise really successful starting to fall behind. I think those things are some of the signs.
Cheris, do you all do training? Like, does Project Oz do training with, for example, Bloomington schools for this?
Yeah, we don't necessarily go into the schools and train other caseworker or other counselors or the teachers or anything. I think we work well with them. We work collaboratively with them. The teachers, the administration, they're all very aware of Project Oz and the services that we offer. And so I think that we just collaboratively work very well together. And so if they identify a young person that may not have a shower or may be falling behind, then they can contact Project Oz and let us know that there's a young person that they're concerned about. And, you know, maybe they don't have the skills to follow up with that young person, but they know that we kind of have a better hold on that, and so we can go in and talk to that young person.
That's Cheris Larson with Project Oz in Bloomington. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Julie Dworkin and Alexis Bishop. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about a new push to make the prehistoric city of Cahokia, near what's now St. Louis, a national monument. Right now, we're talking about what communities in Illinois are doing to respond to the growing challenge of youth homelessness. My guests are Alexis Bishop. She's 23. She's joining us from Bloomington. She was homeless when she was a high school student. Julie Dworkin is the director of policy for the Chicago Coalition on the Homeless. And Cheris Larson is the supervisor with Project Oz in Bloomington, where Alexis has been a client. Cheris, I wanted to ask you a question. We were just talking about sort of the warning signs, and it seems like both you and Julie are saying that it's really a challenge to identify these young people who are on their own. And so I guess my question for you, for Cheris, is what you think sort of the lasting effects are of high school students who graduate, who are part of this population, maybe where they don't have a place to go. What happens after they graduate from high school?
Well, I think a lot of times they fall through the cracks because they haven't been reached, and so they don't have those skills or the encouragement to go on and further their education. That is, even if they graduate high school, a lot of times if they're not identified by anyone, just like Alexis said, they may drop out of high school, they may get into drugs and alcohol, they may get into other kind of coping mechanisms, and they don't have that support system. And so a lot of times youth homelessness then grows into the larger problem of adult homelessness as well, where they're just bouncing around from place to place, and they don't have the skills even to obtain employment. And so that's why it's so important that we capture them when they're young and we identify that and we are able to provide those resources for them and give them those basic life skills that they may not have gotten in their own home, things that we all take for granted because, you know, several of us were taught those things in home or at school, And a lot of these young people aren't. And so we're able to teach them those life skills. We're able to help them build resumes. We're able to encourage them to go and further their education or complete their education. And, you know, it's just basically they just need that extra support and extra encouragement.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Truly, is there, or do we know what the rate is? Is there what the rate of the homeless population, maybe that transitions from being part of the homeless population when they're teenagers to continuing to be that way as adults?
Yeah, you know, there was a study that was done in Los Angeles where they were trying to determine, you know, what are some of the things that determine whether youth are going to become homeless long term. And in that study, they found that about 18% of them were homeless for more than 5 years. So it's not a huge portion, but it's a really important thing to note that there is a group of them that are particularly vulnerable and really need to have that intervention to keep them supported. You know, you were asking about what happens after high school. One of the things that we're trying to do is create some of the same supports that exist in the high schools in the community colleges in Chicago so that they would have a system of liaisons, because a lot of youth do end up starting community college, but then they end up dropping out because they have unstable housing. They don't have any kind of support network to keep them in there. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do in Chicago is, you know, kind of keep those supports going.
Mm-hmm. Julie, what do you think is the biggest challenge in all of this? Is it funding? Is it finding the actual client population to serve?
Well, definitely right now the biggest challenge is funding, because we don't have a state budget and the people who are providing these services to homeless youth haven't been paid in almost a year. So this is really completely decimating the system that we've built up over the years to provide services to these youth. I would say most all agencies now have laid off staff, cut back on services. Everyone's trying to keep their number of clients they're serving level, so they're cutting back on everything else they can possibly cut back on. But as we near the end of the fiscal year, we know that some programs are going to be shutting down, you know, if we don't have a budget in place. There's already been two of the programs in the state that serve homeless youth did close.
So we have two programs that have closed. Yeah. Sharice, what about Project Oz? How are you guys coping with this? You guys haven't been paid for this year then.
That's true. We haven't. So basically, we've been offering a service for the past 11 months without the guarantee that we'll be paid for that service. And at this point, we're continuing that service because we know that there's a need. We've already served 70 more homeless young adults than we did at this time last year. So there's a need. And so, yeah, we've continued to provide those services and we'll continue to provide those services as long as we can. But certainly that time will run out soon as well. And once the new fiscal year starts, and if we continue to not have a budget, then we're going to have to make those difficult changes and those difficult decisions that we don't want to make.
Alexis, what do you want people to know about this issue?
Excuse me, what was your question?
What do you think people should remember about this? As we're hearing about all these programs that are being cut, this is something that affected you personally. You were able to go to Project Oz as an adult to prevent you from being homeless again. What do you think is the most important thing for people who aren't affected by this issue to know about it?
I just want them to know, like, homelessness is not a stereotype. You don't have to be on the streets to be homeless. You don't have to be dirty to be homeless. It could just be, like, a lack of opportunity. Like they said, they might not have the motivation, the stability, things like that, which I somewhat lacked in my life. Project Oz helped me get back into school. They've provided many opportunities as far as my career, just my life skills. I know, for example, they brought in a bank teller, and she told us how to improve our credit and things like that, and I ended up getting an opportunity to work at the bank. So I feel like Project Oz has helped me through so many obstacles in my life, and I feel like other people should be, you know, available to have that opportunity as well. I feel like it's not something that they should cut funding on.
That's Alexis Bishop. Thank you for joining us. Alexis, good luck getting into that radiology program at Heartland.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Julie Dworkin, Director of Policy for the Chicago Coalition on the Homeless, and Sharice Larson, who supervises the Homeless Youth Program at Project Oz in Bloomington. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The 21st. The largest archaeological site in the country lies about 9 miles east of St. Louis in Collinsville, Illinois. It was a massive prehistoric city that had tens of thousands of residents in the year 1050. It was a city that had a grand plaza the size of 45 football fields. And to put it in context, it would have been a much bigger city than London was at that exact time. And in the past few weeks, a movement to declare the Cahokia Mound State Historic Site a national monument has been gaining momentum. Late last month, Senator Dick Durbin wrote a letter to President Obama requesting the change in the designation, which would put the site under the purview of the National Park System. Governor Rauner has also indicated his support. Joining us to talk about this issue on the line from St. Louis at Washington University is Robert Dimmick. He's a professor in geology there. Professor Dimmick, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
In studio with me as well, Thomas Emerson is the Illinois State Archaeologist. He's also director of the Illinois State Archaeological Survey. Thomas, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Professor Dimmick, let's start with you. What would making Cahokia Mounds a national monument, what would making it part of the park system mean?
Well, I think it would attract attention. It would help with preservation. And it would call attention globally to a place that many people just don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm. We're going to learn a little bit more. I'm hoping Thomas can help us learn a little bit more about that in a minute. But I know that this process has been going on for a couple of years. And is it typical for it to take a couple of years for the Park Service to determine whether something becomes a national monument?
Well, this is an unusual situation because most national monuments are actually created from federal land. And that stems from a 1906 act called the Antiquities Act that empowers a sitting president to set aside parcels of federal land as national monuments, thus giving them special protective status. Cahokia is, belongs to the state of Illinois, and there might be private land there. So it's just a very different kind of situation. The federal government can't simply declare that a federal property without an agreement with the state of Illinois, as I understand it.
Thomas Emerson, as Cahokia now is, as Professor Dimmick is saying, is belonging to the state of Illinois, are there private lands involved? Is that a complicated? Does that make it a little more complicated?
Yeah, Cahokia is extremely complicated because it not only is state and federal, well, basically state land, private land, but it also crosses the border into Missouri. So it's actually in two different states.
Okay.
And so it's going to take a really unique kind of agreement, I think, for all the parties to come together. But it's something that's long overdue.
And it sounds like everybody is coming together on this. There's not really disagreement about whether this should become a national park, is there?
No. I think it's something that the archaeological community and the local community have agreed on for a long time. And it's, as I said, it's just long overdue.
Well, also, the other thing that Robert Dimmick mentioned is that most people don't know that much about Cahokia. I was hoping you can help us with that. What was Cahokia like?
Well, essentially, you need to think of one of the big medieval cities or one of the large Mexican cities during Aztec times. It's a center that essentially covers about 5.5 square miles. And it included at one time over 200 mounds and multiple plaza areas, public areas, and thousands of individuals. But that's just the core of the site. There are three big ceremonial centers. What we think of Cahokia is actually owned by the state of Illinois, and that's a very small piece. That's 3,000 acres of 5.5 square miles. The rest is outside that. We just finished excavations, 4 years of excavations for the new Mississippi River Bridge, and we excavated about 4% of one of the other centers.
And that was in St. Louis, then?
That was in East St. Louis.
Okay. Across the border.
Yeah, yeah. So East St. Louis. And, you know, in that slice, we excavated over 1,200 houses and a mound that was not previously known, and that's the tip of the iceberg, and it's buried under 6 to 10 feet of modern debris. So we've got, in effect, it's like Pompeii of Illinois. We've got a buried city that's underneath East St. Louis, and then there was the St. Louis group, which they basically totally destroyed, and so there is nothing left of that group. But that was another major.
That was another site. So yeah. I know that Cahokia may be the origin of what anthropologists call Mississippian culture. What was that? Because it sounds like you're describing a massive city with lots of people organized. And again, I think to remind everybody, this was around the year 1000, 1050 or so.
Yes. Yeah. Mississippian is used by archaeologists as to designate a whole time period, but it really is the first appearance of large-scale urban developments in the New World, in the Eastern Woodlands anyway, and it's also a period when people become full-time maize agriculturalists. So we should be able to identify with
it. And that's corn then, in other
words.
Yeah,
corn.
Okay.
In you know, Illinois, it's like, hey, they're our predecessors. I mean, these people are corn farmers. That's what they do. That's their main crop. It's what they live on. And so that's a total shift from earlier patterns, which are often hunting and gathering or small horticultural plots.
So there was this town or this city, and it seems like there were not just farmers, but there also, I know the material that you all have uncovered has a lot of exotic materials from far away that would also suggest that was there trading that happened?
In the past, there's been a lot of argument that one of the things that made Cahokia grow was the trade patterns, because we've got material from the Arkansas-Oklahoma area, the lower Mississippi River Valley, the upper Mississippi River Valley, and we could see these foreign materials and pottery coming into Cahokia. But in the last 5 or 6 years, we've been working with human remains from Cahokia. And one of the things you can do is look at strontium levels.
What are those?
So that's basically a mineral that shows up in human bones. It's absorbed. And where you get it from is the groundwater where you live. Because geology differs across the area, you have a unique signature for the area you live in. When we looked at Cahokia, we found out that about a third of the people there had a signature that was totally different from Cahokia. So
they would have come from far away.
They've come from far away.
You've also found with the remains evidence of ritual human sacrifice. What does that tell us about what culture was there?
Well, it certainly is associated typically with complex cultural. I mean, it is a pattern that when you get what people around the world think of like civilization, one of the things that comes with it is this kind of level of internal violence. And it's really interesting at Cahokia because the violence we see is internal. It's not really external. There aren't a lot of skeletons that show basically battle scars, you know, arrow wounds. We've kind of joked to some extent, you're more in danger if you're a Cahokian from Cahokians than if you're a foreigner. Because clearly there was something. And you know, again, it's a very early trait. It shows up right at the beginning, but it fades away within probably a couple generations.
I was going to ask how long the city lasted, and it's a big mystery as to what happened to the city.
It lasts from about 1050 to 1350
AD. Okay, so in that 300-year period, what happened then?
One of the other things that's unique about Cahokia is that there's this big burst at the beginning. Tens of thousands of people involved. But then from that point, you can see the population systematically dropping. So it's like people come, stay for a generation maybe, and leave again. Ultimately, in the end, most of our studies suggest that it's internal divisions that probably lead to the end of Cahokia. People have blamed the environment, but those studies don't hold up in the long run.
Professor Dimmick, do you have a theory about what? I think everybody has a theory about what happened to Cahokia.
There is the theory that that around that time the world entered a period of prolonged indifferent climate, but that's not something that's directly relevant to Cahokia. I wanted to add a little bit to something I said before about.
Sure, we've just got about 20 seconds left.
Okay. Well, there's precedent for two other monuments. One called the Waco Mammoth Site in Waco, Texas, where the city gave the land to the federal government. Another place called Effigy Mounds in Iowa, where the state transferred land to the federal government. So
there's precedent for Cahokia.
Yeah,
okay.
Precedent for that.
Well, thanks for that. We appreciate it. That's Professor Robert Dimmick. He teaches geology at Washington University. Thanks also to Thomas Emerson, Illinois State Archaeologist and Director of the Illinois State Archaeological Survey.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester and Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. In the race for the Illinois Senate seat, incumbent Mark Kirk has gone on the attack recently over Representative Tammy Duckworth's record on veterans. A series of ads have rolled out about a lawsuit. There's a hearing today, actually, from two of Duckworth's former employees with the Illinois Veterans Administration. Associated Press reporter Sarah Burnett has been writing about this issue and joins us now to fill us in. Hey, Sarah. So it's a bold, it's a kind of a bold strategy for Senator Kirk to attack Representative Duckworth on veterans issues because as many people know, that's her entire career, including the fact that she lost both of her legs when her helicopter was shot down in Iraq. How much of this is part of his overall strategy for the campaign?
It's a big part of his strategy. Obviously, Congresswoman Duckworth's personal war story is one of her biggest political strengths. And so, you know, Kirk is in a position, already one of the most vulnerable senators up for re-election on the Republican side this year, where he needs to sort of do something to neutralize her reputation and one of her political strengths. And so he really has been going after her on this issue, not just this lawsuit, but some other things about her record while she was with the Veterans Affairs Department.
What's been the response from the Duckworth campaign?
Well, you know, they've called it a desperate attack from Kirk. They say it's clear to anyone who is paying attention or who has followed Tammy Duckworth's career at all that she has, personal investment and has been very committed to helping veterans. They see this as a strictly political thing. The lawsuit itself that is in court today.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about that. What's that about?
Yeah. So it's two women who worked at a veterans home in Southern Illinois when Tammy Duckworth was leading the Illinois department. This was back, she took that job back in 2006. And they basically say that they feel like she retaliated against them, she and the person who was running the veterans home at the time. One of them, they had complained about some of the things that were going on there at the facility, and Duckworth came in and at one point tried to fire one of the employees, soon found out that she couldn't just fire at will a state employee, and so both of those workers still work there. But they say that, they missed out on raises and things like that because of poor performance reviews and
what's the hearing today?
Mm-hmm. The hearing today is the Duckworth's attorney. She's being represented by the Attorney General's office. They're looking to dismiss the remaining counts of the lawsuit. The lawsuit actually was first filed about 7 years ago. They filed it in federal court. It was dismissed there. They filed it again in state court and was dismissed there, and they refiled it for the third time.
Oh, okay. So it's been dismissed twice. Okay.
Right.
Can we get back to the campaign, and let me ask you how tight this race is, and then also how much you think the outcome of this will affect the balance of power in the Senate?
Yeah. Well, the situation with the race itself, almost anywhere you look, the people who sort of prognosticate about these things show it as leaning, toward in Duckworth's favor. Mark Kirk is widely seen as probably the most vulnerable Republican, as I mentioned. It's particularly hard, he was first elected in an off year to the Senate. It's particularly hard for a Republican to win statewide in a presidential year, because in presidential years, Democrats in Illinois tend to turn out in bigger numbers. So he's got that disadvantage going for him. Illinois just as a statewide typically is a blue state anyway. In terms of the overall picture, Republicans find themselves, they're having to defend 24 seats to keep this year and compared to Democrats 10. So they have a lot more seats to focus on. Democrats, if a Democrat wins the White House, Democrats only need to pick up 4 seats. So at this point, people are seeing this as Tammy Duckworth's seat to lose.
That's Associated Press reporter Sarah Burnett on the race for the Illinois Senate seat between incumbent Mark Kirk and Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. At the end of March, NPR launched a new podcast. It's called Embedded.
I'm Kelly McEvers, and this is Embedded, an NPR podcast where we take a story from the news and go deep. And today we're going to Austin, Indiana, a town that back in the spring of 2015 was all over the news. People in one small town in Indiana are addicted to a prescription painkiller called Opana, and they're sharing needles.
As you just heard, All Things Considered host Kelly McEvers is the host of the podcast. She's a native of Lincoln, Illinois, and joins us now from NPR West. Hey, Kelly, welcome back to Illinois, at least virtually.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me. It's always good to go back.
Now, the word embedded, I think you and I as journalists, we think of that, and I think people know it's like a reporter who's traveling around with armed forces or maybe the police in a potentially dangerous situation. Why did you want to name your podcast Embedded?
Well, I covered Iraq for NPR, and I didn't always have to be embedded with the military in order to do my job. A lot of the time, by the time I got there in 2010, we didn't need the military to be able to go out and around in Iraq and report. And so I was often embedded with the people who were at the center of the news. And so I kind of took the term and turned it on its head and thought, what if we took that technique, that approach, and did it in a podcast in the United States.
Yeah, well, I think that makes a lot of sense, I think, especially when we think about journalism these days, how much of it gets concentrated in media centers on the coasts in New York or L.A. And I think people sometimes can have a lot of assumptions about places they've never been. And I wonder if you felt like with your previous reporting experience, like you were just talking about in Iraq, if it really made you think about this issue of how often you end up fighting stereotypes in reporting.
Yeah, I mean, I think also I spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I spent a lot of time overseas. And I think there was a point when I wanted to come home. And there was a lot of thoughts in my head about, like, what kind of stories did I want to do and what kind of stories matter? I think when you spend a lot of time in the Middle East, you think it's the only thing that matters. And got back here and realized there are things that are just as important, just as pressing, that need to be reported here as well. But, yeah, I mean, being from the middle of the country, I sometimes bristle at the way certain people are portrayed and certain stories are done. So it was important to me to approach some of the stories here in the U.S. with a little more depth and a little more sensitivity.
Right. And especially that first episode, we played like just a teensy bit of it, but you go to this house in Austin, Indiana, and it's the center of an HIV epidemic from people doing this drug, Opana. And you start that episode talking about how reporters from all over the country descended on this town, and basically they were just there for maybe not even a day, and then they left. And I wonder how you avoid that, like just sort of the notion of just parachuting in to do a story.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that's the thing, right, that happens all the time, and we all think about it, is how do you go in and treat people with respect and try to do them justice, but also do your job? Sometimes we're under deadline pressure. Sometimes we only have a certain amount of time to tell a story. So with this podcast, I mean, the one thing we have that I think we don't always have in the business is time. You know, we go and we spend as much time as we feel like we need to really get at something. In this case,
yeah, how much time did you spend on that one?
It was 6 days on the ground the first time.
Oh, wow.
A bunch of days on the ground the second time. But, you know, again, like as a news reporter, you just don't get that kind of time to do one story.
Well,
and then we spent, you know, months afterward doing a lot of research about the drug that people were doing. It's a painkiller called Opana. Something that we found was that when that drug reformulated itself to become abuse resistant, basically so people couldn't crush it up and snort it, that is when people started injecting it, right? There was this coating that was put on the pill that was supposed to prevent people from snorting in that. So then people figured out how to break it up.
Yeah, it's sort of this awful unintended consequence.
Yeah. Exactly. So we did tons more reporting on that. Again, the kind of stuff you wouldn't necessarily have time to do on a daily news assignment.
You mentioned that as you were thinking about coming back to the States, there were lots of stories that when you were in the Middle East, you sort of were immersed in. As you've come back here, I wonder what issues you feel like are really important to you that you've been able to cover with Embedded that you feel like.
Yeah, the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. obviously, is a huge story. In fact, when we started reporting that story a year ago, I don't think it was nearly on the radar that it is in the way that it is now nationwide. Police police shootings. That's obviously something that is part of the national conversation right now, something we wanted to look into. We spent time on Skid Row here in L.A. after police had shot and killed an unarmed black man, and wanted to understand police tactics. You know, how do police do their jobs? And so we embedded with the police on overnight and during a day to try to understand how they work and how they approach. We also just looked at, different types of violence in different places and trying to understand how that worked. In Texas, after a big shootout between some rival biker clubs, and also, you know, we stayed in the Americas. We were also interested a lot in immigration. So we've done a couple different stories looking at that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what you learned, I think particularly being in the Middle East for so long and probably being around cultures that were really different from what you grew up with, how that kind of you think has helped inform getting to know people across different parts of the country now.
Yeah, that's funny. If like doing my job for so many years was like literally going thousands of miles, maybe tens of thousands of miles away from home and trying to, and home being Central Illinois, and trying to like be a respectful person who honors people's stories and really wants to listen to them and tell their stories in the right way, but who also tries to understand that like the cultural differences between us could not be more great, and trying to figure out all the different ways that you can try to meet people where they are. And I think that, right, learning how to do that over the many, many years is definitely something that is still something I think about today.
Well, you know, probably because we have those same cultural divides here in this country, right?
We do here right. in this country, mm-hmm. of course. You know, I could go to a small town in Indiana to try to talk to people who are addicted to this drug, who are at the center of an HIV outbreak. This is super sensitive stuff, right? These people are, at the lowest end of the socioeconomic scale. They're living a life that I am not familiar with. So, I mean, in terms of mileage, like the distance between there and my hometown is pretty small. And there are certain things about their life that I completely understand, that I've lived with and that I know. But still, you know, there's still this huge divide. I work for, an East Coast media organization, and I'm coming in there and saying like, hey, why don't you tell your story to millions of people? Like, that's not
what people want to do. Right?
That's not a natural thing, sure. Right? So you have to be completely transparent, completely honest about what this is about. You know, there's no trickery involved. Always have the microphones out. We're just constantly like passing out business cards and just saying over and over and over again who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it. And, you know, and giving people the freedom to say no. I mean, I think that's the most important thing, too, is just like, if you don't want to do this, you don't have to do this. There were several people in that house who did not want to talk to us. And that was fine.
Which you can do when you have time to tell the story. Yeah.
How do you
find your stories?
You know, for me, it's like there's a story that like just sticks in your craw. You know those stories where you're like, it goes by you in your news feed on social media,
and
or like
think,
you see it on the
important.
Like the
yeah.
ticker. I always do this at work. Like I walk by the TV and I'm like, what's that all about? Like I'll point at the TV as I'm walking by. Like it's like some headline where I'm like, what does that mean? You know, it's like, or this one in particular was like, We kept seeing stories about it in the LA Times on like page 16. My husband kept being like, why is there an HIV outbreak in Indiana in 2015 in the United States of America? And I was like, that is a really good question. I want to know the answer to that. And like, I would read the newspaper stories and there was some stuff in there, of course, good journalism. NPR was covering that story a lot. My show, If All Things Considered, was doing a lot of coverage of that story. But I still was just like, I just don't get it. What is this drug, Opana? Who are these people? How could this happen? You know, so it's just a story that just like I can't let go, you know, something that just like makes me curious and my curiosity hasn't been satisfied. You know, same with police shootings. I mean, obviously everyone was talking about police shootings for so long. I mean, I think many people still are with Black Lives Matter protests and on the various shootings around the country. But we just kind of wanted to dig in on one of them, you know, and we wanted to really talk to police. Like, I think the police feel like they've been left out of the conversation in a lot of places. And so we were like, why don't we go just get embedded with them and give them a chance to show us how they do their work and to explain how they do it. And, you know, of course, we found a very big range of thoughts, opinions, and tactics when we did that. And so, I mean, that's the thing, right? And so that's what we're supposed to do. We're journalists. We're supposed to go in and so, dig down.
Yeah, let me ask you. What
people
you,
understand?
Let me
yeah.
ask you. What are you working on now? We just have about we just have about 30 seconds left. But I'd love
we've
to know. Are you coming back to Central
left.
Illinois?
Oh, I hope so. I always have it. I mean, you know, my parents would love that. We're working on an episode about basketball, something a little more fun, less intense. We're working on an episode about Doctors Without Borders. We are also working on an episode about a school that is slated to close, like many schools across the country, and what that means for the kids there.
You can check that out on the NPR podcast Embedded. That's its host, Kelly McEvers, which, of course, you can also hear on All Things Considered. Hey, Kelly, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's 21st, StoryCorps founder Dave Isay is going to be with us. That's all we've got for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.